Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Hey, Jody, I don't know about you, but I'm really getting tired of all these Californians moving into Texas. I think we ought to go and start an appellate law podcast in California and kind of take over there. What do you think?
I like it. I mean, I feel like we've probably said everything we need to say about Texas appellate practice anyway.
Well, everyone who is someone has already been on our show when it comes to Texas. And California is this whole fertile ground that we have yet to plow. So listeners, beware. We are moving into California.
Wait, doesn't somebody already do appellate law podcasting in California?
You know, I'm going to have to check because that is definitely not on my radar screen. But even if they do, Jody, don't you think we could do it better?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Well, we'll check it out. And listeners, we'll let you know. Thanks. So, Tim and Jeff, welcome to the California Appellate Law Podcast.
Well, wait, Todd, I think you mean the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. We are the California Appellate Law Podcast.
Yeah, that's us. Todd, Jody, let us welcome you to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast.
Wait, we're the Texas Appellate Law Podcast.
What's going on here?
Yeah, well, I was telling Jeff that we've had such success in the California market, and I'm opening up a satellite office in Texas that I thought we'd expand. I didn't know if you were doing much in the podcast market these days. How are things going with the podcast? You amenable to a takeover?
Hey, guys, don't California my Texas Appellate Law Podcast.
Every podcast could use a little granola, a little yoga, a little left coast influence.
Yeah, not so much meat in the diet.
This is starting to sound like a bad SNL skit, you guys.
All right, do we have to take the April Fool's bloom off the rose here?
I think so.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, April Fool's to everybody out there. We're still on our respective podcasts, but we do have a crossover episode headed your way.
Yeah, it's been a fantastic opportunity to get Jody and Todd here to interview them. I've been fans of theirs since they started the podcast, and there would be no California Appellate Law Podcast without the efforts of these gentlemen, fantastic lawyers, pioneers in the legal podcasting space.
Yeah, you two created a great set of examples for us to steal from. So we appreciate you very much.
Well, I wish I could say that we were that original. When we first conceived of appellate law podcasting, I took what I had learned from other legal podcasts and tried to apply it. So I won't identify who I stole shamelessly from. Go out in there in the public sphere, right?
That's right.
For our Californians who may not be familiar with you, do you each want to give a quick short bio or introduction of who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'll go first. I'm Jody Sanders. I am an appellate lawyer at Kelly Hart & Hallman in Fort Worth, Texas. And I've been at the firm for, gosh, I guess 17 years now and primarily doing appellate work for most of that time.
All right.
Yeah, I'm Todd Smith. I practice at Butler Snow, which is really a southern regional firm of about 400 lawyers or so, but we have about 15 of us here in Austin, and we have a Dallas office as well that's a little smaller. I've been doing appellate work my whole career. After law school, clerked for a Texas Supreme Court justice for 2 years, and then went into a large firm for most of a decade. And then of some interest, before coming back to a large firm, I had my own law firm for about 15 years. And I think that's where Jeff and I first were exposed to each other, is in the solo small firm appellate world.
Right, right. And for the Texas audience that's listening, yeah. My name's Jeff Lewis. I come from a teeny law firm known as Jeff Lewis Law in Southern California. I do appeals and anti-SLAPP and civil litigation. Most of my practice is anti-SLAPP litigation and appeals. I'm a certified appellate specialist, doing it about 26 years.
Yeah, my name's Tim Kowal. I am the appellate specialist at my small firm, Thomas Vogel & Associates. We handle a lot of business litigation matters, all over money disputes. So I handle the appeals, kind of got into doing appeals, handling the appeals in my own cases until I realized I really enjoy doing this. And maybe I can get some other people to hire me to do their own appeals as well.
Well, hey, you guys are doing great things out in California with your podcast. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some compare and contrast between what we do and what you all do. And actually, we've joked a little bit about stealing ideas from each other. I think there's definitely some things that we could steal from you all when we grow tired of our current format.
That's right.
Great things. But that's the thing. I mean, with podcasts, there's so many out there that you can listen to and learn from. And there's always fresh ideas floating around out there. And I don't know about you guys, but our podcast is really sort of guest focused. We don't always feature ourselves, and we don't really necessarily talk a whole lot about specific cases or things, the matters that are actually being adjudicated in the appellate court. So that's a little bit of a different approach than what you guys do, because when I listen to y'all's podcast, there it is. I said y'all, I think, for the first time.
First of many, I hope.
Yeah. When I listen to y'all's podcast, I hear a lot of specific discussion about legal issues and sometimes on certain cases. So that's a nice contrast, I think, to what we do. Mm-hmm. So when we get tired of just sitting around talking to appellate judges and legal practitioners, Jody, maybe we'll start doing mini CLEs on our podcast.
I like it.
Jeff is working on that. I don't think we've disclosed that on the podcast, that we're angling to release some CLE approved episodes so that some of our listeners can get some free CLEs sitting in traffic on the 405, making their way to the 55, to the 5 freeway.
Yeah. Do you guys have a certification process for certified specialties? Like, yes. Is there such a thing as, and are you folks certified appellate specialists?
I am. Let's see. I think I've been certified. It's the Texas Board of Legal Specialization.
Got it.
That handles that. And there are, I don't know how many different areas now, more than a dozen.
And they've added a few recently too.
As a specialist, I find it really hard to find specialized MCLE that's accessible. So one of my goals in having the podcast and getting approval for MCLE is to offer appellate lawyers certified MCLE, at least in California. That's the goal.
That's great. Texas, we've been very lucky. We have a very active state bar appellate section, and they do a good job of doing programming that counts for the specialization for civil appellate.
What was one thing getting that CLE is not a problem here. Let me also throw out that we've looked into something similar for our podcast. And unfortunately, the way that the MCLE rules work in Texas, you can't broadcast something that you've previously recorded and then have it be awarded credit for a CLE. And so that's something that is of interest to us. Certainly would recommend. We do have up to, I think, 5 hours of self-study credit available to lawyers every year. So anybody who's listened to our show, you ought to certainly feel welcome to apply for that 5 hours of self-study credit, because I think there are plenty of our episodes that would qualify for that.
That's terrific. Well, do you get any feedback or comments from your listeners about things that you're doing on your podcast that your listeners especially enjoy? Do they enjoy hearing from particular kinds of guests or certain kinds of content or stories? Jeff and I are always looking for ways to generate more content that our listeners are going to benefit from. And so I wondered what kind of comments you've heard from your listenership.
I think the answer is yes, it depends. Sometimes we have people that kind of reach out and volunteer themselves and say, hey, I know a lot about this topic. Are you interested in maybe having me on? And most of the time, the answer is yes, unless it's something that just really has nothing to do. I think maybe once or twice we've said, I don't know if that fits, but pretty much everybody else that's ever asked to be on. In fact, we got one yesterday that Todd and I haven't even talked about, and where people kind of volunteer. And a lot of times it's stuff that I wouldn't have been able to find someone because I didn't necessarily know it existed. So that's been pretty interesting. And then some people kind of say, okay, what about these types of guests, or what about these types of topics? And so we've tried to incorporate those when we hear from them as well.
Yeah, I get a lot of unsolicited emails from people who, marketers mostly, who are trying to place their clients.
Got it.
That generally doesn't work. And so we don't typically do that. But Jody's exactly right. Sometimes we'll get some that we wouldn't have thought of. And it's like, okay, this looks like a legit person. Let's have them on.
Yeah.
The ones that I think people really comment on a lot are the judges. Mm-hmm. People really like to hear, it's like our CLEs. I mean, when there's an appellate CLE or really any kind of CLE here in Texas and the judges are speaking, I mean, the crowds will come for that. And so that's been kind of a boon for our show, is having a fair number of appellate judges and trial judges come on as guests.
I'd say that's a bit of a barrier for us. We've had a number of retired justices and judges come and speak. We have never been able to get an active sitting appellate justice to come interview with us.
Are they just worried about what they're going to be asked? Or what do you think that is, Jeff?
I don't know. I know their workload. They have a tremendous workload in our Court of Appeal. I know getting them to come speak in live MCLE presentations is very difficult. And so it could be just a function of that, or it could be we're not quite as famous or infamous as the Texas Law Podcast yet. We need to spend a few more years, get a few more episodes under our belt, perhaps.
You guys,
or it could
been
be
doing...
Tim's ranting and raving against unpublished decisions. Sorry, go ahead, Tim.
You guys have been doing weekly episodes, I think. You've been at that pace since, I think, from the time you started, if I'm not mistaken. When Jeff and I started, we did about once a month. I think we were not even quite at that pace at the beginning. I describe our initial half dozen episodes or so as the rudder guide in podcast form. I was terrified of saying anything incorrect on the law. So it was heavily scripted until we finally decided to have a guest on and realized that, oh, the guests really do all the work on the podcast. You ask them a question and then off they go. And then we've kind of loosened up since then. But you kept up, and it took us until I think just sometime late last year that we finally started on a weekly routine. I think you guys have been weekly, or is it every other week since the beginning?
It's now every other week. When we started, so ours kind of turned into a little bit of a happy accident, actually. When we first started talking about starting the podcast, Blake Hawthorne, who was the clerk of the Texas Supreme Court, said, look, if you guys come down, you can record your first episodes at the court. I'll get you a justice as a guest. And so really, without having spent a whole lot of time talking about our format, our first couple of episodes were just guest episodes. And so we stuck with that. And then we recorded that the first week of March 2020. And then all of a sudden, every judge and lawyer in Texas had a Zoom account and a lot of spare time on their hands, which is how we ended up doing it weekly, because we just started sending out, hey, want to come on our podcast and record an episode? So we ended up with a pretty good backlog pretty quickly, and we were able to transition into weekly episodes on that basis. Then when everything opened back up, I guess, about a year and a half ago, we realized that every week was getting to prove to be too much, both for ourselves and just recruiting guests to keep up that. So we switched to every other week, which I think is a good pace for both of us now.
Yeah, doing a week to start with was good for us to kind of ramp things up, kind of establish ourselves. And then being somewhat established, I think I was just looking at our numbers, our episode count. We'll be at 115 episodes with our next. Having that kind of library is good. And I think we feel a little less pressure that we've got to actually produce all the time. But we like that every other week pace. I mean, it's pretty manageable. It's not hard to guess generally, and we don't get too burned out on it. Not that it was really that much work to burn us out in the first place. We always have had a lot of fun with it. It's been really a great thing for us to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had the same experience. It's been a lot of fun. As I said, I was terrified at the beginning of saying something wrong, but after you learn to loosen up a little bit, then it's great fun. And one thing that our listeners have told us they wanted to hear more of, we are trying to reach trial attorneys. We're appellate attorneys. This is, in effect, a marketing effort. We're trying to reach our target audience of trial attorneys. I always like to say, I like to jump around the corner and scare poor trial attorneys about the sorts of things that can go wrong if they don't hire an appellate specialist like Jeff or me. And so true to form, I've had some trial attorneys tell me, I'd love to have a top 10 tips. What things do appellate attorneys want us trial attorneys to know? So I talked with Jeff, and we made good on that a few weeks ago and released a top 10 tips for trial attorneys bringing an appeal. And then I think last week we released an episode, top 10 tips for the respondents on appeal. You're already statistically likely to win, but here's how to really drive it home, put the nail in the coffin. So we try to give content like that where we can.
I'm writing furiously. I'm taking notes.
All right. There you go.
I think those are great digestible bits of information. And it's the same for us. I mean, really, we started this, as Jody's pointed out, I mean, the timing of it was just kind of fortuitous. But ultimately, it is for us more than being about just sitting around pontificating, which is kind of how we let off. I mean, we do try to provide value to our target audience. And we like it that appellate judges and appellate lawyers listen to our show. But I think our goal has basically been the same. And we really want to provide value to trial lawyers. So we try to do that. We have a little different approach than you all do. But that kind of top 10 list thing is something that we ought to consider doing.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Yeah.
All right, let's jump into the meat of the interview here. One of the patented and copyrighted things we like to do on the California Appellate Law Podcast is to ask each of our guests to tell a favorite war story. Before we ask you, Jody and Todd, to share a war story, I'll share a quick short one, and then we'll ask you two to share one. I was once involved in an appeal where opposing counsel substituted in 2 weeks before oral argument. He had never done an appeal before. He stepped up to the podium and he said, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve all of my speaking time for rebuttal. I stood up as the respondent and I said, I have nothing to say.
Oh.
And the justice was this close to closing the door on him and said, well, I guess we're done. But she showed a little bit of mercy and let him present argument as usual. But that, in a nutshell, is one of my favorite stories showing the differences between appellate lawyers and trial lawyers masquerading as appellate lawyers.
That's a very dangerous gambit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. With that, Jody or Todd, do you have a favorite war story you'd like to share with our audience?
I have one I can tell, and I was just reminded of this past weekend. because we had a reunion of the judge I clerked for, who's long since retired from the Texas Supreme Court. We had a bunch of us here in Austin get together, his former law clerks, and he told the story, and it reminded me of the event that I was around for at the time. But oral argument at the Texas Supreme Court back in the mid-1990s, a young lawyer is getting up to present her argument, and she's handling herself well, but clearly very nervous, and she faints.
Oh my God.
And so the court stops all the action, calls EMS. EMS comes out. She's like, no, I want to continue. Wow. And to her credit, she finished the argument, despite having gone through that obviously rather serious nervousness and the trauma of having EMS called to your first Texas Supreme Court argument. So when the judge was telling, Justice Gonzalez was telling the story this last weekend, he joked, I can't remember how the case came out, but she was really a trooper. So fainting oral argument is the war story I will tell.
But did the justices give her extra time? That's what I want to know.
I think the clock was suspended. Okay. I think she got every bit of time she had coming. Okay. So anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
That Jody, what about you? A tip or a war story?
I'm trying to think of ones that I haven't told, and I just can't keep track of the ones that I've told on here before. But I'll riff on a similar theme to Todd's. And I was at an oral argument, and I won't say what court or anything, but we were the appellee, or the appellant got up and gave our side of it. The appellee got up and started talking, and their nose started bleeding. And they just kept talking, and it was getting worse and worse. And the judge said, do you want a break? And I said, no, it's fine. And just kept talking. And the judge finally said, we're going to take a break. Go ahead and stop the timer. We're going to take a break. And they did, and came back, and everything was fine. But that just reminded me that judges are human too, and they understand that weird and crazy things happen, and it's okay. Don't be a hero to the point where you have to just hold your bloody nose during oral argument. Take the break. Yeah. Take the minute that there's the court's giving you.
There's an acceptable amount of gore for oral argument.
Yes.
Don't exceed it.
The threshold was clearly had been crossed at that point.
Yeah. Right. When the judge offers you a lifeline, take it.
Yeah. So, Tim, all right, everyone here has done something except for you, I believe. So tell us your war story or your tip.
I'm in Jody's boat. I'm trying to think of one that I haven't told already, but I think our audience has suffered through repeat stories before. I'll tell the one I like the best that still grates on me today. It's about a judgment enforcement issue. We had this really great law, California Supreme Court case in California. To set it up, as a judgment debtor, one of the things you're worried about is post-judgment interest and attorney's fees for enforcement costs. But one of the ways to cut off the judgment creditor's right to attorney's fees for enforcement costs is to pay the full amount of the judgment before they file their memo of costs. And if you do that, too bad, so sad for the judgment creditor. They can't get their attorney's fees no matter how much they've run up. So I did that for a client in the case. The trick is that you can't just do it with a check, because the creditor can just hold on to the check and refuse to cash it until they file their memo of costs. So it has to be in cash. Maybe a wire would work too, but the California Supreme Court case on point says you have to pay them in cash. We did, showed up with an armored truck, paid over $200,000. The attorney was livid. You know, who does this? California Supreme Court said, this is what you do. So we did it. The trial judge still said, I don't like it. I'm going to give them their fees anyway.
Oh, gosh.
No fees for
you. No amount of table pounding could overturn it. And by that time, the client was out of fuel to do more appeals. So
that sounds like a Texas story, like something that only happens in Texas, showed up with an armored truck with cash.
Yeah, I never had an armored truck involved in any of my litigation, as far as I can remember. I feel like that would stick in my memory.
What kind of appellate lawyer are you, Joel?
I know. I'm disappointed now. I've got to find a reason to get one.
You've never seen a lawyer so unhappy to have somebody showing up with the armored truck full of cash.
Yeah, big sack of cash. I should have paid the extra fee to get a selfie as he was delivering it. I wanted to ask you too, we're both podcasting during the pandemic. For Jeff and me, I think for all of us, it started as a pandemic project, basically.
It was supposed to be a hobby, Tim. It wasn't supposed to be a real thing.
Tim never got that memo. Yeah. So we were live on the scene reporting on the state of the judiciary in our respective states during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I wondered, maybe we can just kind of briefly talk about it, kind of compare the experiences of respective states' responses to the pandemic. One case that Jeff and I talked about that I thought was illuminating is the difference in responses, even in judiciaries in the same locale. We had the Ninth Circuit taking a different approach than the superior courts here, the state superior courts in Orange County, for example. So the Orange County Superior Courts, I should have a date on this, but this was probably by around 2021, this was happening. They were holding trials, criminal trials. And in this case, Olson versus United States, or is it United States versus Olson? I guess it was. Olson demanded his right to a speedy trial. He says, look, Orange County Superior Court is right across the street holding trials. I want my trial. This is a violation of the Speedy Trial Act. The prosecutors wanted further continuances and the district judge did not grant it. Judge Cormac Carney said, agreed with the defendant that across the street, they're holding trials. What is the difference? Does COVID not affect the north side of the street as much as it does the south side of the street? The Ninth Circuit did not like that because there was a court policy saying that we're going to hold off on trials and that complies with the Speedy Trial Act. Judge Bumate, I was frustrated because there was no analysis of the Sixth Amendment, the actual Constitution. It was just on the statute. But Judge Bumate went through the right to a speedy trial under the Sixth Amendment and said, no, the purpose of it is to prevent criminal defendants from rotting in jail, awaiting their day in court. But this particular defendant was out on bail. So not really any constitutional harm there. But I wondered if you noted any kind of interesting skirmishes or public debates about the way the judiciary in Texas or in the Fifth Circuit were responding to the pandemic.
Todd and I have talked about this, but we feel like our podcast kind of inadvertently ended up being a little bit of a historical record on that. Texas kind of had a double whammy. You know, we got hit by the pandemic and to the everlasting credit of our state judiciary, they moved really fast. And within, I think, a week, Todd, they had Zoom accounts and YouTube channels available for courts so they could go completely online, which was really amazing and got them to do it. I think for the most part, all of the judges moved pretty quickly over to that. So they didn't end up having to stop all proceedings, but the jury trial issue took a lot longer to figure out. And the Supreme Court did it through a series of continuing emergency orders. In fact, they just issued their last emergency order earlier this year. So that was kind of interesting to watch. And then ultimately, over the course of pandemic, some courts, civil courts, figured out ways to do civil jury trials completely remotely. And I think all the judges agreed, look, it's not really a substitute for a regular jury trial, but we can do it if this is what we have to do. I think the criminal side obviously has some different constitutional implications. And I'm not aware of a virtual criminal jury trial. They may have had one or two, but I think they were pretty rare. I think federal court here was a little bit different. And I think the Fifth Circuit kind of left it up to the individual district courts to make their decisions on how they wanted to proceed. My recollection was that the Fifth Circuit was doing virtual arguments. Maybe there were some in-person ones, but I think they just sort of left it to the discretion of the different judges and districts to decide how they wanted to handle it. But the double whammy that kind of hit our courts was the pandemic hit in March. And I think in May, all of our appellate courts were hit by ransomware. So they were all locked out. They're all on the same system. And a number of those courts lost just about everything. I mean, they lost their draft opinions. They lost their internal notes. And different courts, depending on their systems, were hit differently. But it was kind of like they literally couldn't do anything for several weeks while they rebuilt the systems from backups and everything. It was kind of a wild time from about March to June of 2020.
That is some gumption going after the courts.
Yeah.
I got to ask, how did that get resolved? Did they catch the perpetrators? Did the government pay the ransomware? How did they get off?
They did not pay the ransom. My understanding was it was kind of what you think of now as sort of a typical phishing sort of email. And one person clicked on the wrong thing. And the next thing you know, the whole system's crashing. And the problem, as I understand it, was that the backup system was also linked to the same computer system. And so it also got to and unwound the backups. So it was resolved and the courts were able to somehow either reconstruct from documents that they had on their personal hard drives for their computers and so forth. Because by this point, everybody was already working remotely. So there was a lot of data being stored in various places. It did take a long time to get that fixed. But fortunately, once they got it up and running again, things are sort of business as usual. But I think everyone in the state, all the courts have been very well trained on phishing and ransomware now. And it's just unfortunate that we had to go through something like that right on the heels of COVID getting serious.
It's a double whammy. That's really heartless to say.
Yeah, it was.
We're right in the pandemic. What are some silver linings that you've seen out of the pandemic? I think a lot of attorneys have talked about, at least around here, I assume it's the same in Texas. Everyone's got a shiny new remote appearance technology. So you don't have to drive all the way across town to attend a calendar meeting. Even Law and Motions in a lot of departments I appear in are all remote appearance. Is that the same in Texas? And is that a welcome development?
I would say generally it's a welcome development. It's not exactly the same. Jody alluded to the final emergency order that was just issued by the Supreme Court very recently back at, I believe, around the end of January. And what the court did, I think this is very wise, is the court learned from the experience of having remote proceedings and sees the value that brings, such as what you're getting at, Tim, with the efficiency part of it, especially in a state, and California is a big state. Texas is a really big state geographically. And with lawyers trying to represent clients, vastly distant jurisdictions or counties sometimes, the practicality of that is somewhat difficult. But Zoom court taught us that this really can happen, and that it really is a very useful purpose to having this technology stay with us, even after the pandemic has subsided, certainly, and when it's over. So the Supreme Court decided we're not going to have any more emergency orders, which was the authority for courts to proceed with these kinds of remote proceedings. But what it did was it rewrote one of the rules of civil procedure to specifically incorporate the possibility of remote proceedings. And that can be set by the court. It can be set or noticed by the parties, but everyone has the opportunity to object if there is a remote proceeding noticed. And the presumption, though, built into the rules is that all proceedings are going to be in person. I think as a practical matter, everybody knows I don't want to go to a docket call or pretrial hearing if I can help it, Paso this week, which will take a whole day for me to get there and back. So I haven't really seen or heard much anecdotally for how that's gone since the new rule went into effect February 1st. I mean, it's still pretty new, but I think it's generally well received that, hey, this is a good thing to come out of the pandemic, that we now have the ability to, I don't have to get in my car or get on an airplane and go to El Paso for a pretrial hearing. It can be handled remotely. You do have to factor in the fact that it's in a different time zone, which makes things a little bit odd, but this is definitely one of the upsides, is the ability to handle more and more things remotely. And it's also, from the court's perspective in adopting this, it also helps to serve access to justice purposes, because you cut down on cost of having someone going to another location. You can find a lawyer to represent you who's not necessarily in your location, but who can handle your matter efficiently, as long as the remote access stuff continues. So there's definitely been, despite the growing pains we had to go through, definitely been some upside that's come out of it.
Todd, did I hear you say that the courts rewrote the Code of Civil Procedure?
So in Texas, we're not a code-based civil procedure. It's rules based on enabling statutes. So the Texas Supreme Court actually, they approve. Generally, they have a group that kind of writes the proposed rules, and then they post them and have comment, and then they end up approving them. So they actually do write the civil procedure rules.
The brilliant minds in the legislature don't get their hands on how many days you have to file a motion for summary judgment and those kinds of things.
Not unless they get mad and they change it. Up to this point, no.
We do have the legislature every so often kind of poke around and tell our courts, you only have so many days to rule on a motion for rehearing. Or it's deemed overruled by operation of law. That sort of thing does happen rarely, but occasionally. But no, our courts are in a good position to write the rules and amend the rules of civil and appellate procedure. And most of our judges have been practicing lawyers and either litigators or trial judges. So they have some direct experience with those rules. And so I can't say the same for most of our legislators. We have a fair number of lawyers in our legislature, but we have a biennial legislature and it's in session right now. And most of us lawyers kind of hold our breath while the legislature is in session, because we just don't know what they're going to do to make our lives more difficult. Thankfully, it's generally not rules.
Yeah, Jeff, I know that you specialize in anti-SLAPP stuff. And about 10 years ago, Texas did its first anti-SLAPP statute. And it was partly written by lawyers, partly written by legislators. And it ended up swallowing the court system for about 6 or 7 years, trying to sort out all the intricacies of that. And they've amended it a couple of times since then and kind of brought it back more to what the actual purpose of an anti-SLAPP is. But it got real wild there for a while.
The pendulum has not swung back here in California. You have anti-SLAPP motions, which are very useful and important. Mm-hmm. SLAPP smacks strategic motions against credible claims, where the SLAPP procedure is used to bog down lawsuits for years, tie them up in appeals, discovery can't move forward. We have not yet had a swing back of the pendulum yet that's sorely needed in California.
When was the California statute enacted, Jeff?
Around 96.
I know when our version of the anti-SLAPP statute came out, a lot of people pointed to California as an example and cited a bunch of California cases, as I remember. And of course, my thought at the time was, this is Texas. Why do we need to look at California? No offense to my California friends, but there's some ways that we probably could have stood to have looked at California more. But that's interesting to hear that pendulum is still in favor of, I love that term, smacks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wish I'd thought of that and implemented it about 9 years ago.
I wish I had. I stole it from someone else on Twitter who came up with it, and with full attribution. But yeah, especially in the case, it was a frivolous SLAPP motion The other side is sanctioned for filing a frivolous slap motion. They can still freeze things up, take it up on appeal, burn 2 years worth of attorney's fees. It's terrible. It's just terrible.
Every problem needs a good acronym to address.
That's right.
So I will say that that particular issue, we've got the same problem with our statute. And we just recently had on our show our friend Jerry Bullard, who monitors the Texas legislature very closely. So that's one of the issues that's being discussed down the street from my office right now, is whether to keep that stay in place.
Yeah, I think, if I could wave a magic wand on California's law, if a superior court judge has made a decision that no reasonable lawyer would have filed this anti-slap, that's enough right there, A, to sanction, but B, cut off your immediate appellate rights. Be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
Well, that's the first time I've heard you say that, Jeff. Cutting off appellate rights. It cuts out the leg under both through your major practice areas, appeals and slaps.
It's the rare case. It's the exception. It's not the rule. Most anti-slap motions are justified and righteous.
While we're kind of doing a compare and contrast, I think this is super interesting. In our state, the appeals from anti-slap orders are not final judgment appeals. They're interlocutory appeals that we only get by statute. How is that set up in California? How is an anti-slap order made appealable?
I'll let Jeff answer as the anti-slap guru.
The loser of the anti-slap has the right of immediate appeal, and most of the case in practice is stayed. So even if a couple of causes of action are stricken, the remainder of the case, for practical purposes, is stayed. Discovery stayed. It takes 1 to 2 years to wind through the courts of appeal.
Wow.
We have a one final judgment rule.
Yep.
And so basically, nothing's appealable unless it's a final judgment, subject to exceptions. And the exceptions are largely laid out in statutes that make interlocutory orders appealable. Mm-hmm. The anti-slapper in Texas, it's the TCPA, Texas Citizens Participation Act, being just one example of that. Is it the same structure for you all? Have you got statutes authorizing appeals for certain types of order?
Yeah, we have the one judgment rule, and certain things are defined by statute as immediately appealable and are deemed a final judgment or a final appealable order, anti-slaps being a predominant, probably by volume, predominant one.
The legislature felt so strongly about making anti-slap orders appealable, they made them appealable in two different statutes, right, Jeff? There's the appealability statute. It's like A13 makes the anti-slap orders appealable. And then the anti-slap statute itself makes them appealable. They wanted to leave no question that they're appealable.
Yeah.
The only question is whether some of the fee orders. The denials of fee orders, or if you got a fee award, but it wasn't in the amount that you wanted, it wasn't a sufficient fee award, then that's a partial denial. And it's not clear whether those are appealable by statute, but they may be appealable as a collateral order. And there's a split among the district courts of appeal in California on that question.
Interesting thing about California slap law is that the Ninth Circuit entertains slaps, meaning if somebody decides federal court, an anti-slap motion can be brought, albeit the plaintiff gets more discovery rights than they would in state court. Or in the federal system in California, you still get the anti-slap remedy.
Yeah, the Fifth Circuit has said no to that here in Texas. Yeah.
It's a procedural remedy. No slap in federal court.
Yeah.
A bench slap, maybe.
It's not considered a collateral order in the Fifth Circuit.
You can't do it. You just can't file them there because they consider it a state procedural issue.
Hmm. Erie doctrine.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, that is the difference with the Ninth Circuit. They do a little bit of a Frankenstein thing with the anti-slaps because they try to find the justification for hearing anti-slaps in the Federal Code of Civil Procedure, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, as it's kind of a motion to dismiss and it's kind of a motion for summary judgment. So it's kind of in the penumbra and emanations of Rule 12 and Rule 56.
Numbers. Rule 54. Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
So we covered the Texas Supreme Court is the primary promulgator of civil procedure in Texas. You mentioned that the legislature has kind of a smattering of statutes where they like to get involved. But I take it they're co-equal. The Supreme Court in Texas can promulgate a rule that could it be inconsistent with statute?
Probably not. Ultimately, I think the legislature would probably win out. And occasionally the court will do something that the legislature says we don't like. And they'll pass a statute that says, here's what the rule in Texas is.
Right.
Supreme Court, go make a rule that matches this, basically.
Yeah, they do write rules designed to carry statutes in effect very frequently. And so when you said co-equal, it made me think about one thing that's unique about our state, and that is that we effectively have two high courts. We have the Texas Supreme Court, which has exclusively civil jurisdiction, and then the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is right across the hall in the same building, which has final jurisdiction over criminal cases in Texas, subject, of course, to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And different justices?
Yep. Different justices. Huh. Court of Criminal Appeals judges are called judges. They're not called justices.
Oh.
But the Supreme Court takes the lead on rule writing and things like that. But the Court of Criminal Appeals typically signs off on rule changes that have any effect on anything to do with, like, rules of evidence, for example, with criminal proceedings. And so it's a little bit of an odd feature, but there's maybe only one other state. I think maybe it's Oklahoma.
I think Oklahoma might.
That has a dual system like that. So it may be something of interest to your listeners in California.
Well, that's interesting. So that kind of puts Texas in, I'm not sure what column to put them in, because most states, this is what I've read, that most states, their Supreme Courts are the primary promulgators of civil procedure. California follows the federal model where it's mostly set by statute. We have a judicial council here under the Supreme Court that promulgates rules that can be gap fillers, but not meant to contradict anything that's in the Code of Civil Procedure that is a statute. So it seems like Texas is a little bit, doesn't quite fit easily in one camp or the other.
Oh, the other thing I'll add is that our Supreme Court does have a generally good working relationship with the legislature. You know, it has to go there for funding to get its budgets approved. And the idea that the court, that the legislature doesn't tell the court the details of how to do something, as Jody's pointed out, there generally is a statute that's enacted and they've basically said, here you go, Supreme Court, go do something with this. And so I'll just say that our Supreme Court and legislature have a very regular and ongoing working relationship so that the legislature doesn't tend to stick its nose in the business of rules in our state.
I'll give an example. An example is like supersedious. The legislature passed a statute that basically said, here's kind of the limits on supersedious in Texas. They're A, B, and C. And then it was up to the Supreme Court to take those limits and actually craft procedural rules to implement them, which they did in the appellate rules. Yeah, so
that's the one I was trying to think of and couldn't. So thanks, Jody, for having my back on that.
No problem.
Yeah. Nice teamwork. One of the areas in California where the two have been in conflict, I mean, the courts and the legislature, has the area of court reporters, whether or not you can use machinery, whether it's digital recorders or tape recorders to record a hearing. And the way that has kind of played out is there was, I guess, a push for a while to equip certain courtrooms with machinery to record proceedings. And that was met with resistance from the court reporter lobby. And there was a conflicting case. And it turns out the legislature has the ultimate say there. But let me say this. Right now in California, we are stuck with a huge court reporter crisis. If you're in LA County or you take the 405 down to the Orange County, you got to bring your own court reporter to a civil hearing. You still get a court reporter for criminal, but civil in LA, family law or probate, if you want an appellate record, you got to bring your own court reporter. I was wondering, in Texas, is there a shortage of court reporters or audio recordings used and transcribed later?
I don't know about the shortage. I think the general rule is most courts have their own reporter, though that's not totally true. There are some courts that you have to make arrangements for. It's usually more maybe specialized courts or smaller courts, but I think most district courts, which is our kind of general jurisdiction trial courts, have their own court reporters. Uh-huh. Although it's typically incumbent for you to ask for a record. A lot of them don't just have a court reporter that sits down when the docket starts, but that doesn't mean you have to provide it. But there are, I think, some. I don't know of any courts that have done away with court reporters completely. Todd may know.
I do not. I mean, even in our very urban counties, the court reporters are still standard. Mm-hmm. I have heard tell of a court reporter shortage. But as Jody says, I mean, any court that here I go to on a regular basis has an official court reporter. That makes it pretty easy for us. We're not having to provide our own. If you get down to, say, you've got a visiting judge or a special judge under one of our statutory procedures for basically ADR, somebody other than your sitting trial judge for your case, it's pretty common to have to provide your own. Not a significant crisis for the civil litigators here in Texas.
Well, it's easy for the appellate lawyers here on high to say, well, that's a trial court problem. It's not an appellate lawyer problem, until you get handed a record or no record on an abuse of discretion issue, and you're told, hey, go appeal this, and you got no bullets in your gun.
No record means no appeal. No appeal means no appellate billings.
I can see that. That being a problem, yeah, for sure.
That's a water gun. That's more like a Nerf gun than any kind of real weapon.
There are two problems in California. And the first, Jody reminded me of it. I think it was about 10 years ago, Jeff, that because of a budget issue, the court stopped providing court reporters. Yeah. So then they went freelance. So then that was still not a problem to find a court reporter as long as you were mindful. Then the appellate attorney advice was always, did you get a court reporter for your big hearing tomorrow? Don't forget to sign up a court reporter. But now the problem is you show up to these hearings, there's 10 cases on the docket, and there's six court reporters sitting around waiting for their individual hearings to come up. That's a total waste of resources because now since that time of the budget shortage with the courts, now the courts don't have the budget shortage. Now they're throwing money around trying to find more court reporters to sign up to the profession. Because there's just been attrition over the last 30 years. I've talked to several court reporters about this. Why aren't more people signing up? There's court reporter training schools that are closing down. I think we have a gap of, I think there's a Los Angeles Superior Court paper that came out in February that said that the gap that we're trying to fill, the shortage is about 2,750 court reporters is what they say that we need.
Wow.
And last year, there were 150 or so people who sat for the court to take the certified shorthand reporter examination. And of those, only like 37 passed.
Wow. Oh my
gosh. So at that rate, it's going to take 75 years
to
fill that gap.
Unpopular opinion here.
Of Todd Smith. We're just going to go ahead and say this is Todd's individual opinion.
We mentioned the court reporter lobby in California. It's actually the same here. It's extremely strong. But if you keep up with what's going on in the world of technology, you have to ask yourself, is it really necessary? We've got AIs that can pass the bar exam now. So can't we get an AI to transcribe a proceeding? There's going to be elements of human error in every transcript. And is it really worse than AI error? I don't know. And the reason it's going to make me unpopular is because we have people who do work as court reporters, and it's a viable and valid profession. But if we're having trouble filling the seats, maybe it's time to look at other options.
Yeah. Since you brought it up, in California here, I just saw that there is a new bill, 662, has been proposed to allow electronic recording in all civil cases. This was tried and crashed and burned terribly back in the 90s because the court reporter lobby is quite strong. But we'll see if things have changed now because they haven't been able to replace their numbers. And so it becomes a harder argument to say, well, we need job security. Well, we're throwing money at you, but there's just not enough of you. So we need another solution.
Yeah. Let me offer a concurring opinion, if I could, to Todd. I think you will always need a live court reporter at a deposition where you don't have a referee and people are talking all over each other and you need a court reporter to throw a shoe at someone to get them to pause. In a courtroom, whether it's a dude or a dudette in a black robe who can maintain order in the courtroom, a tape recorder is just fine. Then you hand it over to AI afterwards. I'm with you.
And we actually have in our rules a provision that allows for court recorders, but very rarely, I can't think of a case I've ever handled, Jody, where that was an issue. I mean, everybody tends to default to the traditional way of dealing with getting a record. So,
Well, and now that we have all this shiny new remote appearance technology, everyone is mic'd up and camered up. All you have to do is hit the record button, at least have an unofficial digital recording that you could turn into a transcript later on. But in California, the court reporter lobby thought of that. And so they've got a statute on the books here that says you may not record under any circumstances except for the purposes authorized under the statute. So you can't.
Interesting that came from the court reporter lobby and not the courts themselves.
Yeah, it's a statute. But let me ask you a couple other questions for purposes of comparison. One of my favorite hobby horses is about unpublished opinions and the related issue of stare decisis. In California, it's unlike the federal system. There's no horizontal stare decisis here. So the first district court of appeal can issue an opinion on Monday. The second district court of appeal can issue a completely 180 degrees opinion on Tuesday. And then the first district can come back around on Wednesday and reverse itself in another case. It's not even binding on itself. So no horizontal stare decisis. I wonder if that's the same or different in Texas state court.
It's different. I mean, in terms of it's all persuasive authority, but in Texas, you can cite, I think, any unpublished opinion since 2003, and we do routinely. Oh, wow. Which works out really well because with 14 courts of appeals, I mean, so many questions have at least been answered somewhere. And that doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily follow it, but they definitely do that. And then we have another interesting wrinkle. They do docket equalization here among the courts of appeals, where they try and make the statistics so that each individual justice in the various courts have about the same number of cases, which means that you get cases transferred all over. And they've changed the rules pretty recently where whatever the law of that court is comes with the case to the new court. So even if they might have a different rule in Amarillo, they have to apply the Fort Worth Court of Appeals precedent if it came from that court.
It's a little different on horizontal here too, because aside from unpublished opinions, our courts generally sit in three-judge panels, and you might have the problem of a different panel of the same court reaching a different conclusion on the same issue, similar case. But that's really what en banc review is supposed to be for. So technically, the decisions of that court are binding on other panels of the same court, but they don't always know that. It's like two ships passing in the night sometimes, but that is a very specific purpose for en banc review under our rules, is to make sure that the body of law within that specific jurisdiction stays uniform and that there's not conflicting precedent.
Well, that's interesting. So you have in the Texas state appellate system, you have procedure for en banc review.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Every court of appeals has it, although we have a few three-judge courts that it technically is kind of meaningless.
Those guys are going to pretty much know what their own opinions are, though.
Yeah.
It's not as big of an issue. It's when you get to a court like Dallas and maybe the Houston courts where Dallas has more than a dozen judges. So, and of course, our Supreme Court, every decision is en banc in the Supreme Court. So there's not an issue there. But yeah, it does get to be kind of interesting with the larger urban courts specifically.
And Houston actually has two separate independent appellate courts with the exact same geographic jurisdiction in the same building. So in theory, in Houston, you can have both courts in conflict with one another. Oh. And you just kind of have to guess and hope you get to appeal to the right court.
Yeah. So which one is binding?
Both of them. That's the tricky part. Yeah.
They're both binding.
That's more like California, I'd say.
That's one of my more frequent bits of advice to trial attorneys. Hey, look over my appellate brief. And I'll see binding appellate authority says, I said, take out the word binding. None of our appellate authorities are binding on any other appellate court.
Well, your pet issue, though, about unpublished opinions, Tim, that used to be a real problem in Texas. And about 20 years ago, the Supreme Court changed the rule so that unpublished opinions, they don't even call them that anymore. It's now you have an opinion, which is something that gets published in the official reporter, and you have a memorandum opinion, not an unpublished opinion, but a memorandum opinion, which doesn't get published in the official reporter, but it's readily available on all the usual sites. And so it does count as binding authority, if you will. But before that, there were published and unpublished. And the reason why it got to be a problem, aside from the fact that, and it's totally related to your observation, the fact that the courts, they knew what they were putting out was not going to be used against them or anyone else. So in my experience, some courts would basically unpublish everything that they put out so that it would decrease the chances of Supreme Court review.
Yeah.
Wow. This was kind of a widely known fact 20 years ago, but it's really not an issue now, thankfully. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is my hobby horse. Our audience has heard it quite enough. But yeah, the unpublished opinions, I'll just share again. One of my favorite bits of advice that we got from a guest on the podcast, former appellate justice James Lambden, said that because there's no horizontal stare decisis, even if you find an unpublished opinion that's on all fours and you just so wish that you could have cited it, it's not binding anyway. So just take the arguments that you like. Yep. And hope that they're persuasive, because that's the only thing that's binding is a persuasive argument.
Yeah.
That was the strategy before the rule changed, was you find that one case, that one unpublished opinion that was on all fours with yours. It's like, well, can I cite it? I used to have lawyers in my office at the time. Can I cite it? No. But fortunately, as Jody's pointed out, I think you actually can cite those now. They are persuasive authority. So the work of the courts of appeals pre-January 1, 2003 is not wasted.
That's right.
Yeah. Quick question just about evidentiary rulings. All evidentiary rulings in California, like in federal system, I think, almost always reviewed for abuse of discretion. Always been a little bit perplexed by this. Hearsay is, either hearsay or it's not hearsay. It's not a discretionary call. In Texas, same way, is it all discretionary?
Pretty much. I mean, I guess arguably if it has something to do with an interpretation of the text of a rule, it could be de novo, but good luck spinning that.
The way that Texas answers that question is to say that the court has no jurisdiction to decide what the law is. Mm-hmm. The law is the law. So if you misinterpret the law, you abuse your discretion.
Oh, interesting.
That really comes up the most, I think, in mandamus.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to have a discovery fight or something.
I think you guys call it writ of mandate.
Yep, writ of mandate. Yep. We don't like Latin in our courts.
Yeah.
Although writ of mandamus is a different thing in our superior courts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Hey, a couple weeks back, I showed up for oral argument as the appellant. And before I can even spit out really my opening line of my brilliant outline, Justice read off a 3-sentence tentative ruling. which is the rare, rare exception. In our courts, you don't get tentative rulings. And sometimes once in a blue moon, you'll get a focus letter. Hey, we want to hear about this issue. Out there in Texas, do you folks get a tentative ruling or focus letter ever in the courts of appeal?
No to the tentative ruling. Very occasionally, I see a focus letter, which I think most practitioners really appreciate. I've had it happen maybe 5 times over the course of my career. So it happens, but it's increasingly rare, I think.
I think we've discussed on the podcast before. I actually handled an appeal in California many years ago, and it was a Rancho Cucamonga.
Yeah.
And the court issued a tentative opinion a week or so before the argument. So I went out and argued, and the tentative opinion was in my favor. So it was like the easiest oral argument I ever had to prep for, because it was like, you got it right, holding up the opinion. Can't find any fault with this reasoning, judges. And I actually really liked it. I've never had that come up again in all my years of practice. So I think there's some benefit to that. Focus letters, yeah, it would be really nice in more cases to know exactly what was drawing the interest of the appellate court before you got to OA.
In Texas, do you have a right to written opinions in all your cases, even when the court is going to affirm? In Florida, for example, they do per curiam affirmances, and it's just a summary affirmance with no rationale given. That blew my socks off when I heard that, and I thought, how can you live with that? You put all that time and investment into that case, and that's all you get, affirmed. Period.
Yeah, we do have the right to a written opinion. This is kind of where the distinction between a memorandum opinion and an opinion is made. But there are sometimes, well, in appeals as a matter of right, your ordinary appeals, absolutely you have a right to a written opinion that decides the issues presented to the court.
Yeah. Let's see. Are there any other procedural tips, traps that you think may be unique to Texas that you think other jurisdictions should adopt? Or you think that maybe anything that you like to get on your soapbox about and complain that Texas really needs to fix this problem?
I will say
kind of why I started this jurisdictional comparison analysis. It's kind of assuaged some of my frustration with things that I don't like about California procedure and see if it's actually different or maybe in some ways we do some things better than other states. I was especially alarmed when I found out about that Florida rule that you don't have a right to reasoned opinions on affirmances.
Let me answer your question with a question. How soon after a final judgment is signed is your judgment enforceable?
Oh, immediately.
Okay. One thing that I like that we do is you can't get, say, a writ of execution on a final judgment for 30 days after the judgment is signed. Yeah. And so one thing that made it difficult for me earlier in my career when I would move between state and federal practices, the federal rule used to be more like California, where it was practically immediately. It was a very short period of time before the judgment could be enforced. I think the federal rule has changed since then, but it is kind of nice to have a little bit of a buffer from the time the judgment is signed before you know you're going to be facing a writ of execution or a receivership, or you might get post-judgment discovery, but typically that's not going to be due for 30 days. And so that part, I think, is not being able to go and start collecting immediately does help clients who are judgment debtors try to get their ducks in a row and get a supersedious bond or do whatever they're going to do to try and get the judgment stayed.
I will say one area that I think Mike could use a little improvement is we have two different records. You have the clerk's record, which is all the papers that are filed with the clerk, and then you have the reporter's record, which is the transcripts. You have to request them separately. It sure is nice. I've had a couple of appeals in the Fifth Circuit where you just say, okay, send the record up. Here's the things that need to be included in the transcript. And then you get one nice PDF file with all of it sequentially numbered and it's all together. And you have to do a lot of maneuvering here sometimes to get either record done, and your time runs from the later of the two filed. And so it would be nice to have kind of more of a federal system where it all goes together, numbered together and all up at the same time, but
yeah,
it works.
Yeah, that's one thing that's also different in California as compared to federal is that in the federal system, the appellate record is basically just everything that's in the trial court docket. You're supposed to send up an excerpts of record. They call it in Ninth Circuit. And I think in the Fifth Circuit, everywhere else calls it the appendix. But that's just for the ease and convenience of the judges on the panel. But if there's something missing, it doesn't mean, aha, appellant has waived and forfeited this argument. But you can still cite to the docket. It's still in the record. It's just not in the convenient, handy-dandy appendix. In California, if you don't put it in your appellant's appendix or in the clerk's, identify it to be included in the clerk's transcript, you've waived that issue. It's done, gone forever. I even recently got an appellant sanctioned for making arguments based on evidence that it forgot to include in the appendix. So it's a big deal. If you don't transmit everything from the trial court docket into the appendix or the clerk's transcript, you're done and gone for in terms of appellate review.
Those kind of gotcha rules just really shouldn't exist, especially in a world of pro se litigants or lawyers trying to
Yep.
Maybe a little out of their lane trying to handle an appeal, because it just really, there's too many bad things that can happen that really don't affect anything, but it's just a matter of somebody didn't check all the boxes. And yeah, that kind of thing. All right. One thing I can say about our Supreme Court and the approach to rules is it really has tried to take away those sort of gotchas from our system, so that they actually reach the merits of issues and things aren't decided on waiver. The first point in an appellant's brief or an appellee's brief really isn't that the appellant waived their entire case. That shouldn't be. Well, I want to ask you guys a question that has to do with something we touched on a little bit here about bonds and stays. In Texas, an appeal, just because you file a notice of appeal, does not mean your judgment is not enforceable. And so is it the same in California, or does an appeal automatically stay a judgment?
That commands a lawyer answer. It depends.
Okay.
It's all kinds of
fair enough.
The default rule that everything is stayed. And then the exception is almost nothing is stayed. And then there's just a whole host of exceptions to the exception. So that's your starting point. Money judgments are not stayed. And so you have to get a bond, except for money judgments that are just entirely cost or attorney fees awards. And then those are deemed to be fall under the normal rule that they are stayed.
Except
and I have an
anti-slap fee awards are absolutely never stayed.
Jeff always knows where I'm going with that one. We have a running debate on that. There's a split of authority on that. Jeff won't even acknowledge that there's a split of authority.
There is no split.
None of it's binding authority anyway.
Yeah, right. Bonds and stays are a big overlooked area of appellate practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a huge, you filed your notice of appeal, you're assembling your record, then you've closed the door and turned off the phone and you're happily doing your brief. Meanwhile, your client is getting hit with levies and writs of execution and judgment debtor examinations. And where are you? You're just happily plodding away.
Tim, climb down out of the ivory tower and get them to stop executing on this judgment.
That's right.
Just be patient.
Yeah.
That's right. That's why I tell them to hire the armored car and show up with the money.
That's a really good way of wrapping back to the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I think we've saturated our audience with a lot of appellate procedure nerdery at this point.
Well, I do want to hit you guys with a lightning round. I think we've got a few minutes to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, in keeping with our initial approach to this episode of our podcasts, period, this is the time for our patented copyrighted segment of the Texas Appellate Law Podcast that answers the most pressing questions that vex appellate nerds around the world. The dreaded lightning round. Short
Jeff,
responses.
I think you need to send a cease and desist letter. That's our patented copyright.
We are incorporating it at this point. So, Jody, why don't we tag team them on this?
All right.
Short responses, one sentence. Jody, you can go first.
All right. So what is your font preference for your brief, guys?
Well, there's no preference. They're just the right answer. Century School Book.
Ding, 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 ding. Totally in agreement with that. Another firebrand question. Two spaces or one space after a period?
Absolutely one.
Yeah. I'm not as fervent as Jeff, but I'm a one spacer also.
Okay. I'm a oneer myself. So I'll view that as the correct answer without passing any judgment on Jody.
No, it's okay. All right. Headings. How do you do your headings? Caps, initial caps, sentence case?
All caps is just shouting, unless it's like a one word, like introduction. Otherwise, try to do all my headings sentence case.
Same.
Initial caps.
You're still holding on to initial caps, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm old school. I'm conservative.
I kind of like initial caps too, but I'm trying to come around to sentence case. Okay, dashes. M dash? Are you an M dasher?
I'm an N dasher, the shorter dasher. Mm. I used to be an M, the long dash with no spaces on the side. But when I externed at the Court of Appeal here in Santa Ana, they didn't use that. They used the N dash, the shorter dash with spaces on either side. That's what I've done ever since.
I don't know how to properly use dashes, so I avoid them. Those and commas. My sentence is too long if it involves commas or dashes. So
none of the above. I like it.
Isn't this in Strunk and White, guys? I mean, isn't there a right answer to this question?
I think the Chicago Style Manual says it's M dashes, the long dash.
By the way, I should say Tim prepared this list and he did so with his bias. So I have to insert a question. Out there in Texas, do you folks use the parenthetical citation or the parenthetical signal of cleaned up? You guys use cleaned up?
I have used it, but I will say it depends on the court that I'm in. If it's in a court where I've seen the other judges do it, I'll do it. I don't necessarily trot it out in ones where I haven't seen it.
I feel like it's my obligation to help bring courts and judges into the 21st century.
Yes.
So I will use it regardless of where I am, but I use it judiciously and only when it really adds to the content.
I'm the lone holdout then. Yeah. I'm the holdout. Yes, I've never used Cleaned Up and I have no plans to use Cleaned Up.
Yeah. And you hate it so much, you even deleted off our lightning round list.
I included it.
No, it's on the one I have.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know how we wrap this up, but I'll tell you guys, it's been a lot of fun. I
think
we could have talked easily another half hour.
Oh, absolutely.
But we've gone maybe a little longer than either of our typical episodes run. So this is a great idea. I'm really glad we did it. And I think we ought to consider doing it again sometime.
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was disappointed at the low number of y'alls. I wanted to hear more y'alls. And Jeff, I thought we were going to hear like more jokes or something.
Yeah. Yeah, dude.
Well, maybe for the next go around, y'all. Okay. We will switch out a host for each show. And
yeah,
I really thought that was a creative idea one of you had, but this turned out great. We're really glad to get the opportunity to do it. And thanks for taking the initiative on it.
All right. Yeah. Likewise. Great to have you on the California version of the Texas Appellate Law Podcast.
or the vice versa. We really appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.
All right, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.